court will proceed to the second case of the day, Gavin versus AT&T Corporation et al. Mr. Krislow.
Good morning, Judge Flom, Judge Posner, Judge Canny. There is no doubt that what AT&T authorized Georgeson to launch on the AT&T shareholders was a fraud. To be sure, Judge Grady actually upheld the allegation in the complaint, modified in one respect, but it was not one in connection with a purchase or sale of securities. Much as it's always a pleasure to appear here, we have for the last 5 years been trying to plead to every court that we could that this was not a federal case. This is not SLUSA, because even after DABIT.
Yeah, what's curious about it is, there is diversity, isn't there?
Yes, there diversity is not. Well, I don't know that. There may be diversity. I don't know that there would be with AT&T, but it was removed solely under SLUSA.
But your complaint in the Illinois Circuit Court says that AT&T is a New York corporation with its headquarters in New York, and Georgeson is a Delaware corporation with its headquarters in New York, and Gavin is an Illinois resident.
But nonetheless, even if there is complete diversity, the amount in dispute is about $1,500 between Ms. Gavin and the defendants.
But you're seeking punitive damages. It's in your complaint, anyway.
It may be, but the fact is whether punitive damages would never in this case, under any measure, result in, on an individual basis, reaching $75,000 on a $1,500 claim. The case has proceeded as a square peg in a round hole, or vice versa, whichever one you want, throughout the past 5 years. In spite of our efforts, we were basically required to plead the case as a securities fraud case, and I think that even if SLUSA did reach this case, which we do not believe it does, nonetheless, it still satisfies to state a fraud.
Do you think that AT&T made this deal with Georgeson? Georgeson makes the money from it, right? The $7 a share, whatever. So what's in it for AT&T?
AT&T, we believe, gets to clear these shares off of its books. Whatever they may be sitting out there, Georgeson bills this as a benefit to issuers, and indeed, the usual is a roundup or ride out, which is you get a postcard which says you can either have us buy you up to 100 share round block or get rid of your shares entirely, but in either case, the cost will be no more than generally $20.
Why would AT&T care, though, that?
To get rid of the shares?
Right, yeah. Why is that?
I believe it must. We didn't get any discovery except very minimal with respect to Georgeson's call records. Judge Grady would not permit us discovery. We believe that there is something about the certificates remaining out there on AT&T's books, which is some tale that they would like to get rid of. There's nothing in the record to tell us exactly what their motivation is. AT&T, indeed, thought that the price that was being charged, even at the per share basis, was excessive. The limited discovery that we got showed that even AT&T said that $5 a share was more than enough to defray the costs of the process and a substantial profit. The actual amount, we have never been able to determine, but it appears to number at least tens of millions of dollars. 44,000 people turned in their certificates through Georgeson. If they had 100 shares apiece, which, grant that they probably did not all have 100, it clearly gets up to tens of millions of dollars for the most ministerial of transactions. This is not a broker transaction. This is not where somebody's selling their shares. They're not induced to sell their shares. All they're doing is they're taking their certificate. It may be one certificate. It may be two. Might be ten. They send in their certificate, which they could have done at that time, to AT&T or to Equiserve, its transfer agent, and had the process done for free. They were entitled to that.
Is the problem that the certificate has the wrong name on it?
If the certificate has the wrong name, it doesn't matter whether you do it through Georgeson or through... Oh, you mean the wrong name of the issuer?
Right.
No, it doesn't really matter. By the merger that had been in June of 2000... all of the former U.S. West Media 1 certificates had been converted into rights to receive AT&T shares. So that was not a problem. I thought you meant if the person's name was different.
No, I was just curious about why the certificates have to be exchanged.
I guess we are too, but we can only, if the court will either remand stating this is a cause of action or just remand us back to the state court, we'll eventually find out, I'm sure.
For whatever in this cheat to the state, it was mentioned in the
yes. One of the things that in the notice was pointed out that if you don't turn in your certificates, they will escheat. And that was the threat of not threat of God, but the threat of losing your in the notice that we're talking about, the December notice, they were told that if you don't send in your certificates, they will escheat. That they didn't say if you don't send in your certificates to us, they didn't reveal that you could still send in your certificates to AT&T. The fact is, in some states they might have, in some states they would have been recoverable, but the fact is clearly the way that the notice reads puts the fear of escheat into any certificate holders. And indeed, these certificate holders, all being the remnants of Ma Bell's certificate holders, which was the widest held security in certificate form, rather than everybody who gets out of college these days and sets up a broker's account in street name, certificates may be disappearing, but not among this group. This group is the former AT&T shareholders who suddenly had, I believe, eight different additional securities from the baby bells. And when the baby bells started to reconsolidate, they started to get these mergers. And although we didn't get discovery on this, we believe that these are predominantly elderly people who held AT&T shares in certificate form. And I acknowledge they might have sent in their certificates already. It would have been in their interest to send in their certificates right away. But if they passed the first notice, which was to send it in to Equiserve, this notice certainly didn't apprise them of their ability to still send it into Equiserve. This notice said, we have engaged Georgeson to receive your shares, and it will cost you $7.50 a share, which is an outrageous... It's an outrageous to apply any per share charge, I believe, is an outrageous and an unfair amount. And under the state cause of action, under consumer fraud, it's a different standard. Securities fraud has been versed in the way it has because Congress wanted to rein in the cases based on pumping up the value of the stock. When the stock drops, it was believed that people then sued. Well, this is not one of those cases. This is not a case that Congress intended to rein in. In fact, the only other case that we could find that had ever been done on this per-share basis was a state case that we did 10 or 15 years ago dealing with ADR certificates, which imposed a per-share charge, and on appeal was basically upheld as a cause of action. The fact of the matter is, under the state, this is a garden variety, if you will, consumer fraud. And under those statutes, all that a person has to do is to be deceived. In fact, under Illinois' statute, it is sufficient to allege mere unfairness. We think that under those statutes, this is clearly a fraud. We think it's a fraud even, it's actionable even under 10b-5, but we don't think we have to go there.
Are there any cases or anything in this record which shows that There have been a per share charge for this type of cleanup.
The only other things that we could find were the other the more modern practice of this roundup or ride out postcards that people get to where they have sub shares or less than 100 shares, where you receive this postcard and it says, and Georgeson does this quite frequently, and where the issuer rides herd on this, they'll make sure that there's a cap because these people are going to continue to be their shareholders. And those have an overall cap. You're not talking about a transaction which has a broker's risk. You're not talking about a sale. You're not talking about that type of transaction. There really are. And we look because of the concern about where Dabit throws its borders. We looked for cases to define that line. And the line that Dabit has is really in connection with a purchase or a sale. Here, the purchase or sale transaction was 6 months gone, and all of these shares had already been converted into shares, right to receive shares of AT&T.
When you say a cap, you mean so much a share up to...
Yes. Yes. You get a postcard typically if you have 12 shares. You get a postcard because it's administratively expensive from the company's standpoint to continue to send out annual reports to you. They'd like you to be either gone or round your shares up to 100 share block. Their decision, but usually you get a postcard that says we'll charge you X dollars a share up to $20 because the amount, will never be more than 99 shares to increase it, and to sell it will be something less, so that and those are sometimes subsidized by the company, but usually there's a cap, and we think that wherever a $20 cap, nobody would complain about. Probably even in this situation where Ms. Gavin had 235 shares, I believe, and we're talking about $1,500 to turn in her old certificate. There was another one in the New York case where a trust company had held, I believe, 1,200 shares, Mr. Goldberg may correct me, and paid like $18,000 to turn in their old certificate. I mean, it's incredible to me that somebody would do that, but the fact is when you get this notice, they clearly felt that this was the only avenue to exchange their shares, that whatever they could have found out, and that's what the defendants want to say is let's impose the 10b-5 standard. And the 10b-5 standard is based on the fact that the price of a stock is generally takes into account all the public information that anyone could figure out because it all gets into the mix and it all gets factored into the price. Here, that's an inappropriate standard because there's nothing that, looking at the four corners of the document, people would have known that they could have still sent in their shares through Equiserve or to AT&T and gotten it done for free, which was their right, or that this was an outrageous amount. And we think that this is not appropriate. That's why we think this is not appropriately done under the 10b-5 standard. But if you have to, nonetheless, it is a sufficient fraud. We do think that Judge Grady erred in holding that it was only those people who called. Now, he held... The reason that we're appealing at this point is because he held that it was a fraud upon people who called. People who called Georgeson to inquire and yet still paid the per share charge must have been clearly defrauded, he figured, because once there is an inquiry, there's a duty to speak fully. And so he upheld the basic cause of the complaint. We think that once you wrote a letter, once the defendants wrote a letter to shareholders, there was a duty to speak fully as well. That's why we did not agree. And this case sort of went up in its own sort of odd, the square peg round hole posture. That's why, in spite of the fact that we were ordered to replead, which we think under this court's holding we didn't have to replead, but we did.
The argument is, of course, that AT&T gave two notices earlier and told them they could turn their shares in.
Yes, but that didn't entitle them to intimidate people into the expensive route. They could have said, or you could send it in to us directly, it would have been for free. In fact, AT&T, in its agreement with, and that's where AT&T seeks exoneration, in their agreement with Georgeson, AT&T the said that the agreement says if someone asks, Georgeson must tell them about the free alternative. That clearly was usually not done, but the fact is AT&T never went back and checked on it. The only thing is in the limited discovery we got, we saw that there were some emails said that the charge that was being exacted was higher than would be reasonable.
Would there have been anything to prevent AT&T from saying at the outset, you know, you have 30 days to respond, and if you don't, you know, we're going to turn this over to Georgeson and they're going to charge you an arm and a leg, something like that.
That would
any legal inhibition, prohibition against setting some reasonable deadline
right.
And with a charge afterwards?
Under our argument, it would have been, that might have been fine as well had AT&T done that. You know, but they didn't do that.
No, I understand. So there's no federal law or something which says they can't set a deadline for these exchanges of certificates for shares or selling them? Or
we don't know of one.
That isn't argued here. Though.
That is, they don't assert that no one found anything along that line. I believe that is this the end of my time except for the reserve rebuttal? So I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Criswell. Mr. Mattioli?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Eli Mattioli. I represent the appellee Georgeson shareholder. And I would like to respond first to some of the questions that were put to Mr. Criswell concerning other charges for this kind of service, because I think it puts this entire argument in the wrong setting. This wasn't briefed, but I'll make statements that we've made to the Second Circuit, and we can follow up if the court is interested in the subject matter, and we can provide a letter. There are a number of states in the Union that have statutes that specify specific percentages that can be charged based on the value of assets recovered for lost property that has already escheated. There are a number of other states, and New Jersey comes to mind not just because it's my home state, but because it allows by statute for pre-escheat recovery of lost property, 35%. This charge here was nowhere near it. There's also a case.
Why is it? Are you representing AT&T or Georgeson?
Georgeson.
Oh, you represent Georgeson. Now, so you say this is all governed by state law. So I don't understand I don't understand how this suit is in connection with purchase or sale of a covered security. The purchase or sale occurred, you know, months earlier, and this is just some trading of certificates.
Well, it's not. It's really more than that, Your Honor, respectfully. I think it's settled law that a merger does involve a purchased sale transaction for purposes of the securities laws, and specifically for the purpose of determining whether the in connection with requirement is triggered. Secondly, this notice.
I didn't get past first. The sale was complete before they, you know, ask you whether you want to turn in your certificate.
The sale was not complete in this sense, Your Honor. The exchange of certificates had not occurred with respect to this entire population of addressees of this notice. And they, through their inaction, had extended the purchase-sale transaction, had extended the merger process.
Could the merger have been aborted as a result of this process?
The merger, I do not believe, could have been aborted, but so, these folks, had they not received this notice, might have gone on and not ever reclaimed their shares.
Right. Maybe I'm not tracking this, Mr. Mattioli, but is it your position that a merger doesn't occur till the last outstanding share hasn't been exchanged?
It's my position that the process of exchange of shares does not is not completed.
Well, I appreciate that, but I mean, I thought in response to Judge Posner, you were bringing this under the federal aegis because of the merger aspect. So, I mean, as a term of art, or just as a well, just in fact, is your position then that that's why I asked you about the merger being aborted? The merger is in fact really done, isn't it?
The merger process has the merger itself has been completed, but as to these shareholders, they have not received their shares in the new company in AT&T, nor had they by this time cashed out, which is something they could have done in the early options that were offered them directly by AT&T.
Right.
In fact, through inaction, they had lost the opportunity under the terms that were extended to them by AT&T to cash out. They were deemed to have made the standard election.
Suppose I bought an automobile and I bring it home and they say, and oh, by the way, you know, there's a warranty, but you have to sign the warranty and send it back, something like that. Wouldn't the sale be complete even though this ministerial detail hadn't been completed?
I wish I was better versed in the
well,
world of warranties.
So take my word for it. Why do we want to stretch? The law is concerned with people suing because something went wrong in the merger, there was a misrepresentation, something of that sort. Why do we want to stretch it to cover this sort of cleanup of this detail which happens after the merger? What's the federal policy here? As you said, the states regulate this S-cheat stuff. There doesn't seem to be any federal concern with what happens to the certificates. So why bring it under the federal law?
This notice offers every shareholder the option of selling their shares on the open market. And that's in plain language in the notice. Mr. Krisloff frankly acknowledges in his brief that that would be a good argument as to those shareholders who elected to sell their shares pursuant to this notice on the open market, and says it just doesn't apply to his client because she didn't elect that option. That's one. Two, I think that his argument, and your question may be a different way of asking, why doesn't a case like Isquith govern here, and why aren't we really taking a narrower view of the in connection with requirement? And I think the reason we're urging that the court below, Judge Norberg, correctly did not take a narrower view of that requirement is because the SLUSA statute has broadened the remedial purposes of the securities laws to the extent that there's a congressional determination that class actions for above 50 claimants involving nationally traded securities we should find a way to put these cases in the federal court and remove them from the state court.
But that's question begging, because the question is what's in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. Congress could have gone farther, I suppose, you know, and say concerned about these suits about charges for trading in your certificates, but it seems what's the point?
The standard that Dabbitt has held.
I mean, you're not arguing that they're really trying to challenge the merger in this way. They're not trying to challenge the merger. They're trying to say, as I say, the core of securities law requirements in this area is not to make a misrepresentation in the sale of securities. And there isn't anything like that here. There's no misrepresentation in the sale of securities being alleged, is there?
Well, according to this complaint, there was fraud in connection with the sale of securities. In fact, the complaint alleges specifically that the defendants undertook to review the investments of the shareholders.
To do what?
Undertook to review the investments.
Review?
Of the
what does that mean? Review the...
In the complaint, it states, and if I read the entire allegation, maybe we'll know what it means. Defendants undertook to review the investments of and to provide advice and counsel to plaintiff and the other U.S. West Media Group shareholders regarding what would be in the shareholders' best interests concerning the exchange of stock pursuant to the terms of a merger. And that's in the amended complaint as well as in the original complaint and in the second amended complaint. That claim is in every pleading that's been filed by the plaintiff in this case. And if that doesn't say that there was an investment decision that was presented to these folks in connection with this post-merger cleanup, I don't know how Mr. Krisloff in
and
his...
And the investment decision is why?
I believe here whether to accept their shares in AT&T or under this notice elect an option that effectively had been lapsed through their inaction, and that is to sell their shares on the open market.
And what's the difference between getting the shares and selling them?
They were told what the then recent trading value of these shares was, and they were told what they could do to sell the shares. And this transaction, I think, clearly touched on this is alleged fraud in this notice that Mr. Krisloff has argued is a garden variety consumer fraud. There are allegations of fraud with respect to what the plaintiff calls an investment choice, and it coincides with a purchase sale transaction. As a matter of law, a merger.
But they're not suggesting either that AT&T was trying to induce these people to sell their shares? I don't understand.
Well, I think there is the allegation that there was an effort by AT&T and Georgeson to get people to respond to this notice.
The fee that Georgeson charges is independent of whether, I mean, it's murky, but it seems to be independent of whether you sell or keep your shares, right? The way it says, for this service, which is defined as selling or keeping the shares, they're charging this fee. They're not telling you to sell rather than keep, are they?
And the notice does not offer advice on that.
So it's not, as I don't understand how they're trying to influence an investment decision.
Well, I believe Mr. Krisloff's theory has been that there was an urgency about this notice, a sense of urgency conveyed, that basically did induce people to react to the notice.
No, I understand to react, but it's not that they're trying to get them to sell their shares. It doesn't care. They can keep them or sell them, either one. Right?
Pardon me, Your Honor. One of the ways they could react was to sell their shares. That's what the notice invites them to do.
No, it invites them to do either. It doesn't invite them to do one over the other, right?
That's correct.
Right.
But one of the things it does invite them to do is to sell their shares and cash out, an option that they no longer had under the prior notices.
When you sell your service to somebody like AT&T in these circumstances, what is the advantage to what do you sell? What do you tell AT&T they benefit from?
As I understand it, the purpose from AT&T's perspective is simply a matter of the corporation's responsibility to a new population of shareholders. Judge Posner had asked a question earlier, would they have to give any more than one notice and say there's a 30-day time limit, and if you don't react, so be it. As far as I understand, there is no law that requires AT&T to do this, and that their purpose is simply to do something to enable new shareholders or people who are entitled to become new shareholders to exchange and complete, with respect to them, to complete the merger process.
What happens if there are escheats with regard to these shares? How does that affect the merger and the completion of the merger?
In fact, I understand from my co-counsel for AT&T that there have been some escheats.
Well, maybe you can answer the question, right?
And I think that he might be in a position to answer that question. We have not been involved in that part of it.
Have you ever been sued under 10b-5 for this kind of transaction?
Has Georgeson been sued?
Yeah.
In the Second Circuit, we were sued a number of times, and then the Second Circuit affirmed the dismissal of all of the complaints that allege exactly what's alleged here.
No, I don't mean growing out of this, but I mean in the past.
No, Your Honor. The only other suit that Georgeson was party to was a suit in the New York State Supreme Court that alleged that this was an unconscionable fee, and the Second Department Appellate Division there held that it was not.
And is Mr. Krisloff correct that there's no diversity jurisdiction because of the amount in controversy?
I don't believe that he is, because of his punitive damage claim.
Well, of course, you know, we have the ratio issue about punitive damage. But then what are you fighting about? I understand. Then the case Well, or let me put it this way. Your removal petition didn't mention diversity, did it?
I don't believe we did.
But don't you want to be in federal court?
We think the case belongs in federal court because it's a federal security.
SLUSA, but why? I would have thought you'd, even if it were a diversity case governed by Illinois law, I would assume you would prefer to be in a federal than in a state court. I mean, that's sort of the theory of SLUSA, isn't it? That defendants in security suits would rather be in federal court.
Indeed, that is our desire to be in federal court, and it was clear enough to us that notwithstanding a six-month lag that was brought about through the inaction of the shareholders here, this was indeed a transaction related to the purchase and sale of securities.
But did you put all your eggs in that basket and not plead diversity as an alternative basis for removal?
Your Honor, we think it's very clear. These same arguments on jurisdiction were made both to Judge Stanton by Gavin's counsel.
I don't think your argument is clear at all, so I'm just curious why diversity wasn't pleaded as an alternative basis for removal.
It was our determination that SLUSA was a clear basis.
No, I understand. But ordinarily, if lawyers have two equally good arguments, they don't just chuck one in the waste paper basket, right?
I guess in your view, we did that here.
Right. Okay.
The Second Circuit also had the same argument made to them by Mr. Krisloff, and something that's called a suggestion of a lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and it's in the record here. If I may turn to the 10B5 claims briefly, I think it's clear enough for the reasons that the Second Circuit held in the Starr case that this notice, this PMC notice, contains no misrepresentation either as to the existence of alternative means of exchange or the timing of the sheet and when that would occur or the amount of the fee per share or the total amount. I think that Mr. Krisloff, again, focuses on the time delay of 6 months and argues, in essence, that this information had become stale, the previously disclosed information. And I think the law is clear that once the information is in the public domain, there's not an obligation to repeat it. And there wasn't an obligation here for Georgeson to tout its competitors.
I thought your last notice was extremely misleading. There's absolutely no hint in it that there's any alternative to S-cheat, but to be S-cheated other than to pay your fee.
Well, the notice is couched in terms of what will eventually happen. And it's
extremely misleading. It would be so simple to put in a sentence, say you don't want to pay the fee, you can, you know, you just go to Equisir or whatever it is.
Your Honor, respectfully, if the obligations of any law, securities laws or state law, were that, then this service would not be provided. I don't think any of us would decide that that was a good business proposition for the person who provides the service. If I were a real estate broker and said,
you have to tell the truth, you have to tell the truth. You can't sell your product.
That's
true. You would have to give a person a reason. It isn't actually that difficult. You know, you can get all sorts of software free, but companies nevertheless, you know, like Red Hat, they sell this free. They sell, you know,
open
Linux.
Source.
It's free. But they sell it, and they explain to you, yeah, you could get this free, but you wouldn't know how to set it up, right? So we're selling it to you, so you'll get instructions. So similarly, if you're offering a service of any value to anybody, it's not just a complete scam, you can explain why it is your service has value, even though they could get what looks like the same thing for nothing.
I'm not saying that Georgeson is precluded in some way from doing that, but there's not an obligation under law for them to tout a competitive alternative service any more than my local real estate broker needs to remind me of information that's reasonably available to me, that I can sell my home myself. There happens to be.
You know that. But people who receive these mysterious communications from securities firms, they don't know what's going on. They don't have any idea.
Well, these folks have been told twice previously of the alternative of the transfer agent.
Right. No, I understand. And there was nothing. That's your best argument. Yeah.
And there was nothing in Georgeson's notice that implied that they still couldn't do that. It doesn't.
Well, I don't know. I think someone who'd read the first two notices and then gets the Georgeson notice would say, "Well, I guess I missed my chances, and now I have to pay the $7 or whatever it is, and be as cheated." I think a lot of people would react that way.
If they did and they had that question. I think the obligation of disclosure under the securities laws is met by offering them an alternative. They can call and they can ask.
We've been through that, you know, with consumer finance fraud cases, whether it's enough to say call. And we say, no, it's not enough. For one thing, whenever you call, right, you're put on hold. So it's not an adequate I mean, arguably, it's not an adequate alternative to a disclosure in the letter itself.
If it were not an adequate alternative, the SEC has enforcement jurisdiction for the reasons that we argue this case is properly in the federal court pursuant to the SLUSA statute.
Does the SEC know it has jurisdiction?
Well, the NASD sure does, because they've asked our client for information many years ago, and our client passed the test of reasonableness.
No, NASD enforces its own norms and so on, but there's a danger, of course, if the SEC doesn't believe this kind of transaction is in connection with sale of a security, but we rule that it is, then isn't there a gap in the regulatory coverage?
No, I would say to the contrary. The purpose of the securities laws is served by this court affirming the determination of Judge Norberg that this case was properly removed. And in Isquith, you asked the question, What reason would there be for us to play with words and find a purchase-sale transaction in this deal that involved a spinoff? And I'd submit that if Isquith were a case that were filed in state court today, and I removed it to the federal court, the answer to that same question, were it asked again, would be to put this case that involves a fraud on shareholders in connection with an investment and in connection with a choice they have now to make. Do they accept shares? Do they exchange them through Georgeson? Do they sell them on the open market through Georgeson? That is a case that involves a fraud, an alleged fraud, in connection with a purchase or sale of securities that properly belongs in this federal court. Not to address your question of whether it's a misleading notice, I think the notice simply doesn't touch on the existence or not of an alternative. And if it did, or if that were the obligation, again, I can't think of the company that would provide that service. As far as the last point, I need to address it, if I may have one moment.
Okay, just 30 seconds.
Either there was no jurisdiction to grant discovery post-dismissal to find a new plaintiff, or if there was, the standard was abuse of discretion, and there was no abuse of discretion for Judge Grady to say that with 16 potential claimants whose claims would depend on individualized reliance and who predominantly are from the New York, New Jersey area, with only one of the 16 from a neighboring a state neighboring Illinois, would there be a good reason for him to allow discovery for something that was unnecessary? At the end of the day, plaintiff Gavin, who no longer had standing anyway, and her counsel had the names and addresses of those 16 folks. So we think that he should be affirmed in that respect also. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mattioli. Mr. Goldberger.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. I'm aware that our time has expired, so I'll be very brief.
That's right.
May it please the Court, I am Norman Goldberger, and I represent AT&T. Let me start by addressing the question that was raised. We are under no obligation to continue to solicit our shareholders for their exchange of their shares. However, as a matter of good corporate relations, we tried three times. Twice on the Equiserve notices that we sent, and one with the notice that's an issue in this case. It is an investor relations matter. We did it in order to maintain good relationships with our shareholders. No federal obligation, no state obligation. It is something that we do so that our shareholders do not lose their property, and that's what I want to come to next.
Because if they get us cheated, they're angry.
That's right.
They're
angry with us. Right. They're angry with the system, and we don't. That's not a good thing to have in the public domain. However, I think that that's the very point that gets missed in this decision and discussion about whether it's a ministerial act. It's not a ministerial act.
Yeah, but it doesn't have anything to do with the merger.
It may not have anything to do with the merger, but it's clearly a purchase or sale, and let me explain why. One of two things is going to happen if these folks, all 44,000 of them, as Mr. Krizlov says, don't do something. They're going to lose their shares or they're going to get new shares. Their old shares are worthless. They can't be traded. They can't be sold. Nothing can be done with them. There is, in fact, an exchange going on, a sale. The sale is for the new shares. If you don't buy them, you lose them. That's what happens. You lose your property rights.
Well, if they escheat and there's no value and they still escheat?
They escheat. They escheat to the state. The state gets the value. We have to pay the value to the state. And, in fact, there are cases where that has occurred. And the states come after us on a regular basis
for
that.
So the state becomes the shareholder.
State becomes the value of the shareholder. That's right. They wind up selling the share. I understand the problem with the merger issue, but I really do think that it goes from being a worthless piece of paper that you can trade in. It's a barter transaction, and that's a purchase or sale any way you look at it. And one way to think of it, for example, would be if instead of the $7 share per share price, perhaps Georgeson had charged $300 per share, reducing the value of somebody's shares to almost nothing. That in itself would be a transaction in which the share price had been reduced and the shareholder gets nothing. And that's in connection with a purchase or sale of securities because the security price has been reduced. That's the same thing Mr. Krizlov is saying. My security price was reduced from X to X minus 7. That's what he's saying. It's a reduction in price. That's a purchase or sale. It's classic. And therefore, I really do think it is within SLUSA and in connection with the purchase of a sale, and it touches a securities transaction.
Anything that happened after a merger to someone's stock interest would be a reduction in value, right?
Not anything. There are things that could happen to someone's stock interest that isn't a reduction in
value.
What if
his certificate got burned up in a fire?
That isn't a reduction in purchase price. That is a ministerial act. You come forward, you tell us that, and we give you a new share. That is a ministerial act. This requires you to do something to acquire the property. You have to acquire this asset. This is buying that asset.
Was there any change in valuation after the merger of these certificates, or were they locked?
It's fixed. It's fixed. It's a fixed transactional price.
And how much were the?
I think it was $85 a share plus fractional shares. There's dollars. It's a mixed dollar and share. Transaction because that became the standard election. So that when you reduce it by $7, you reduce the price. That's what you've done. You've reduced the price, and that's the complaint. We've reduced the price. So in classic market terms, you bought something, now you're buying something for something and getting something less than what you bought. The only other point I want to make,
except apparently the SEC doesn't treat it this way.
But it could. The SEC could regulate this.
But it seems that the state's regulated.
I don't think it does. There is nothing in state law that regulates this.
But when we were discussing the substantive issues, it seemed clear this is a standard consumer fraud type of case. You know, they say you can call someone. Is that adequate? What does that have to do with securities law?
Your Honor, the problem is that if this were a car or a pen or a microphone, you'd be 100% right. Securities are different. And the SEC can, in fact, regulate this transaction, does, in fact, impose restrictions on, for example, proxy solicitations, what you can say, what you can do, what you can charge. This is akin to that. The fact that they have not does not mean that they can't.
It's akin to proxy solicitations. I mean, proxy solicitations are about the governance of the corporation.
And this is about...
This is about avoiding escheat by a state.
No, it's about getting shares into the hands of your shareholders. And it is about the protection of shareholders. And the SEC is about the protection of shareholders. If the SEC chose to legislate in this area, it could. The fact that it hasn't isn't dispositive. The question is, could it? And it could, because this is securities, this is a public issuer, and in fact it could reach for these securities and regulate how this is done.
Now, why does AT&T... Oh, so you said this is just investor relations.
Yes,
that's
Your Honor.
Why you, but there would be no problem. What is the price of AT&T stock?
Today? Days? Your Honor, I don't know.
But is it under $100?
I believe so.
Is that the problem? If it were $100, you wouldn't have this problem?
No. I don't think it has anything to do with that. I don't think it has anything to do with that. The problem that we had here was simply that we had investors who had certificates. They were going to lose their property rights. They were going to forfeit their rights.
I understand this public relations, Mr. Goldberg. But why do you care whether – why does AT&T as an entity care whether the state of New York – cashes in the share versus Mr. Jones?
We care because our investors...
And why would the SEC care that you care?
Oh, well, I think the SEC would care a great deal. The SEC cares about investors and their property rights and whether their property rights are adequately protected.
Look, one way you can have property escheat to the state is if you don't have any heirs, right?
That's correct.
You die, you have no will.
That's correct.
You have no heirs, so the state gets your shares, right?
That's correct.
Well, no one would think that the SEC had jurisdiction over state inheritance law with regard to shares of stock.
There's no doubt about that, Your Honor.
But the only thing that's involved here is escheat. If there were no escheat risk, you'd have no investor relations interest, and there wouldn't be any provision of this.
But
there wouldn't be any of this stuff.
But this isn't probate. It arises out of the merger transaction in the first place. Think about the transaction as a whole. We have a merger, two companies, a subject of intense SEC concern, and then the end result is that shareholders wind up with new shares in a new corporation. The SEC wants to make sure that the people got what they were supposed to get. For example, what if we had just simply never delivered shares? Would the SEC have an interest in that? If we had just never delivered shares, if we had said to the Media One shareholders, look, it's nice that you approved this merger. We're not giving you our AT&T shares. See ya. The SEC could absolutely
yes,
sue us for fraud.
But you did give these people their shares.
We did not, because they didn't ask for them. We did not give them their shares because they did not ask for them. That's the problem. We didn't know how to give them to them.
You acknowledge their entitlement. It's just that you're not sure whether the shares actually belong to them or belong to the state, right?
We wanted to make sure that they got to them.
I don't think the securities law cares whether states own people's shares by virtue of state escheat law or the people themselves.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I think the SEC cares very much that the investors receive their stock. I think it's very important to them.
What if a state had a law that any time someone sells shares of, well, that every any time someone receives shares in a merger, he has to give 10% of them to his mother-in-law. Would that raise a federal question?
It might, if the SEC so ruled. I think the SEC would have jurisdiction to enter into that realm. Yes.
Let me just ask you another question. Why isn't this case within the diversity jurisdiction?
Your Honor, my understanding, I wasn't in the case at the time, my understanding is the reason you raised. There was a serious concern on our side about whether we could adequately plead the amount in controversy. It's that simple.
But you know what's so surprising about that? So he said that your predecessor said Gavin had only $1,500 in compensatory damages. Well, you know, we have in our bed bug case where each of the plaintiffs had $5,000 in compensatory damages, we upheld an award of $185,000 in punitive damages to each of the plaintiffs, which was a ratio of more than 30. So, and we said when the awards are very small, the Supreme Court's single-digit ratio test is inapplicable. Now, that of course is controversial. The Supreme Court might disagree with us, obviously, but all you need for diversity is a good faith claim. And couldn't they argue that, given the small size of her compensatory damages, they could ask for $60,000 in punitive damages, or
$73,000. We might have, Your Honor. It was 5 years ago when this was removed, and I'm just not sure we had enough guidance at the time, and we didn't want to take the chance.
I'm sorry.
One more question. That Second Circuit case, Starr versus Georgeson, how close do you believe? I mean, I know you argue it's close. Is it as close as you say? Is it identical to this?
It's identical. It's this program. It is this program challenged under 10b-5 with a 10b-5 complaint. The Second Circuit had no problem seeing the in connection with. It was pleaded as in connection with. Exactly as Mr. Mattioli said, a suggestion was made by Mr. Krizloff that it should be dismissed for want of jurisdiction. It was not. It is on all fours. It is the same case, and it upheld the program and said there was no claim.
Thanks, Mr. Goldberg. Mr. Krizloff.
I was going to go call my mother-in-law. Shaw versus Schwab, which is a Central District California case, held that the broker's overcharges on trade commissions didn't relate to a purchase or sale, but related to the brokerage firm's delivery of stock was not preempted by SLUSA. That's one that would answer their questions. Some of what they've said is just wrong. The question, well, the sale was not complete. The sale was complete. The merger was not extended. The merger occurred. By the merger agreement, which is in, I believe it's attached to one of the original complaints, but it's clearly in the record, upon the merger's becoming effective, which it did, those former U.S. West Media One shares became converted into rights to receive the shares of AT&T. And those people were beneficially shareholders of AT&T from that instance because whenever their old certificates were turned in, they would acquire not just their new certificates, but also all accrued and unpaid dividends. The exchange of shares thus had been completed. They had been cashed out of their old shares. The notice, and there is a typo, and unfortunate